Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marg Regan. Never mind the adage, you are what you eat. How about you are what you see? The latest culprit when it comes to childhood obesity could be the likes of Homer Simpson and the Cookie Monster. There's a new study that finds that kids who watch fat cartoon characters are prone to eating more. Join us on the line to talk through these and other medical headlines is Art Kaplan, artist head of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU's Langone Medical Center. He's also the co-host of the Everyday Ethics podcast. Hello there, Art.
Hello.
Hello, Art Kaplan. Well, before we get to fat children, because we talk about fat children, it seems to me, and fat grown-ups all the time here, I want to start with a story that is broke my heart. If people don't know about this little Hitchbot, this little robot that could talk and tweet and dance and sing and engage in trivia debates, was hitchhiking, you know, around Europe and around the United States. Well, it didn't get far in the United States, and that's the point. It hitchhiked its way across Germany and went to the Netherlands and 3,600-mile trek across Canada, according to this piece in the Washington Post. No problem. And then it gets to the United States and lasts just 2 weeks when it winds up in Philadelphia, Jim's hometown, right where he grew up. And what happened?
It didn't survive.
It didn't survive. So, torn limb to limb.
Now, let me be clear. Jim's from there.
I am.
You all may remember, I lived there, good 15 years. Mm-hmm. I was at the University of Pennsylvania before moving up to New York and NYU. So I know Philly. Hitchhiking as a robot in Philadelphia is suicidal. I mean, it's just, you can't do that.
I've always said that, Art, actually.
Yes. And I'm sure Philadelphia now is the world leader in roboticide.
Yeah, I mean.
So I don't know what this tells us. I know the rest of the country is saying, Philadelphia told you so. I don't know if you saw this, but the guy who is on tape actually destroying the robot.
No.
Is wearing an Eagles jersey.
as in the Philadelphia
no,
Eagles.
No, I did not know we had the culprit on tape.
Yeah. And
it's probably Robert De Niro, but go ahead.
Did he give any explanation why he was doing this?
I don't think they've talked to him or caught him or chased him down. Maybe they're sending the Terminator out after him. I don't know. The robo police. I think it's a sad day when you can't send your happy, smiley robot, which was basically a trash can with a cell phone, by the way. This is not a robot that could, like, talk to you.
I can't believe you're making so light of this. Thousands and thousands of miles through Western Europe. As Marjorie said, 3,600 miles in Canada. Other people are picking him up, putting him in the car, driving him 100 miles. Doesn't this say something a little strange about America?
In Philadelphia, it does. In Philadelphia, they recognize things that are pathetic. That robot was pathetic.
Oh, Art, you're heartless.
It was a trash can with a smiley face and a cell phone and a little thing printed on its head that said, you know, transport me to San Francisco or something.
Yeah.
They don't put up with that there. That's like.
Okay, rock. I give up.
Okay,
I give
that's
up.
The end of that. I love little Hitchbot. Thought he was adorable.
So can we move on to something? Marjorie said it is true. We talk about obesity, childhood, adulthood, all the time here. Because obviously,
obesity,
I had a little.
Are us.
I had a little experience with the issue myself when I was a kid. But there's a new a study that suggests that if a kid is looking at a fat cartoon character, he or she is more likely to eat fattening things, or at least in greater quantity, as opposed to looking at a more svelte cartoon character. You buying it or no?
A little bit. I mean, I think we know that when they pulled cigarette smoking out of movies and television shows, that helped diminish smoking. And I think, you know, you get used to the size of things being bigger when you see bigger characters on TV, bigger characters in cartoons. I think I mentioned to you at the hospitals in the U.S. now, everything has been upsized. I don't know if you noticed this when you go in the waiting room. The chairs are wider.
Surgical
beds are wider. And what happens is, and maybe Marjorie knows this, they upsize also the fashion sizes for ladies' pants and dresses and things.
I did know that. Yeah.
Yeah. So, in fact, you accommodate to, you know, more obese people, more obese kids, and then it starts to become the norm. You don't feel pinched or squished, and you see people on TV that look like you, and you figure, so yeah, I buy it a little bit. I mean, you know, I'm sure the biggest influence isn't watching, you know, more chunky people on cartoons, but it's part of the way you normalize larger sizes, I think.
You know, one of the reasons that didn't surprise me at all, inside the study was 68th graders. It was reported in the New York Times. Children who had seen the, quote, rotund cartoon character helped themselves to more than double the number of candies. The reason it makes sense is I assume people, including you, but people who care about such things, say that having all these anorexic-appearing models on television and in, you know, in print advertising is really bad for young girls. Well, if that has an effect on young girls' mentality, why is it unreasonable to think that if you see a fat cartoon character, it's likely to give you permission maybe to do something that you might not otherwise do? So
I think there's something there. Again, you know, I think it's more important that we got rid of recess and nobody can move anywhere and you're watching TV for, you know, 12 hours out of your 24. These are all bad. Movement is clearly important. But, yeah, it's got to be a part of it. We sort of – I'm going to name names here. I'm going to call out something. You know Mike and Molly, the TV
show?
Sure,
yeah.
I always wondered, what's the impact of that with two pretty heavy folks as stars? You know, obviously, the TV producers are alert to a growing size of Americans, and they put. But I don't think you'd see that show in Europe, not with those people.
Well, years before that, a far more successful show, Roseanne Barr, and her husband, who was great, I can't think of his name at the moment, John Goodman,
thank you very much, our colleague.
John. I mean, same sort of deal. But, you know, at the same time, I'm saying I totally understand the response of a little kid to this fat cartoon character. I'm also saying to myself, so what are we supposed to do? Have an unrepresentative sampling of humans and cartoon characters on television? Because the reality is we're a pretty fat country, unfortunately.
Yeah, yeah. And so, that's that's the response to me. It's sort of like, hey,
maybe a diverse group.
Put people on there that are diverse. And
yeah.
Some of it's ethnicity, but some of it's size. So let them all be there. And I get that. And I think, again, if I was really going to launch the war on childhood obesity, I would start, but remember we've talked in the past about our friends bringing the fryers back to the lunchroom.
Yes.
And making sure that everybody has a gigantic healthy dose of carbohydrates every day at lunch. I mean, those are the biggies. The cartoon thing is, you know, it's a curiosity. I'm sure it's not helpful, but the big deal is, where's the physical activity for kids?
No, I agree.
Going off all the activity. I mean, I don't mean elite high school sports or junior
high
school.
Sure, recess.
You know, recess and being able to go run around and that sort of stuff. And PE, phys ed, has been dying. And then, you know, you got them for lunch and you might have them for breakfast, so do what you can with the kids. I think those are the drivers. The rest probably is just a reflection of failure, the fat cartoon character.
So we have no recess for kids and no sex for old people.
Yeah.
Essentially,
you know,
tell the story.
This is a great story. This is a little bit reminds me of the baby boomers getting old now, because now that the baby boomers are getting old, we're finding out that a lot of the boomers that are at the oldest end of the spectrum are having lots of sex. We hear about these STDs at these retirement communities and stuff like that. But the story is only mentions in passing that they are having.
Could you give me the address of that retirement? What's going on? What do you mean? What are they doing there?
Well, I guess they're hooking up in the sunroom, Art Kaplan, and good for them. But anyway, this story talks about how Medicare is taking away any kind of coverage for men who are impotent and can't afford these drugs like Viagra or these other things that help you with your impotence problems. And it does seem to me that since the Cialis and Viagra are pretty expensive, it leaves poor elderly Americans out to ship without a paddle, as it were. No pun intended.
So I'm with you on this one, Marjorie, because, look, part of what we should spend our healthcare dollar on is to extend our lives, and that's good. But part of it is quality of life.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you can't read because no one pays for your glasses, and sex is important, and I know they have these pumps and pills, I think some coverage there is appropriate. You know, if people can enjoy themselves with their spouses or make new friends or hook up in the sunroom or whatever they're doing, I think a healthcare system that doesn't pay attention to quality of life is going to be a healthcare system that makes older people in particular start to think, I don't want to be here. You know, it's not it's great that somebody can cure my cancer, but if I can't do anything, they won't let me work. I can't walk far. I can't see well. We have to start to understand in our healthcare system that the only measure of success is not days of life added. It's also quality of life.
Well, also, just for the women listening, this story does answer the obvious question, which is that Medicare does cover hormonal creams and rings and things that women need to continue having sex into their older years, too. So it's not a sexist kind of thing.
And so, you know, we used to have battles about they'll cover Viagra, but they won't cover birth control.
Right.
Those old fights. And then they sort of got that all squared up. The problem also is they've been, dare I say it, raising the price of Viagra and Cialis and those pills steadily. I think the prices, just like the cancer drugs, are out of control. We don't have people sort of jumping up and down about the price of these erectile dysfunction pills because, again, people just don't think it's that important. But let me put it this way. When some people get prostate cancer, and you tell them that they might be impotent, they say, well, I'm going to reject the surgery and die. That's how important it is.
Well, they say in the story, Art, that the Viagra has a wholesale price of $38 per pill, and that's wholesale.
Right. I mean, I kind of remember when it was more in the 15, 20 buck retail price. I don't know what's going on with that, with those medicines, other than they can get away with charging ridiculous rates. And I know the rates are so high that there's a ton of fraud about buying the stuff on the internet, you know, deep discount prices coming in from faraway lands and who knows what they're selling you. But just to return to the point, I do think that there ought to be kind of a list or a range of things, mobility, vision, hearing, recreation, sex. That's part of what the healthcare system ought to be responsible
for. Couldn't agree more. Yeah, I'm really disappointed in you, Art, when you missed Marjorie's imagery of being out to sea without a paddle for these men. It was really disappointing. You just let that pass. But, you know, if you missed it, you missed it. Them's the break.
I'm not hearing as well as I used to.
Okay. Art Kaplan is our medical ethicist. All right, the next one is one of the saddest stories I've read since I read about the robot that you had absolutely no empathy for all.
This no sympathy for the robot. This I'm going to tell any other robots
okay.
Don't come to Philadelphia.
Well, this is a real human being, and this is about this 75-year-old British nurse who was in good health herself, but she'd been caring for a lot of elderly people and really was upset with the quality of life, as you mentioned before, of a lot of the people she'd cared for, that they were, you know, just out of it and in terrible physical shape and in terrible mental shape, and basically decided she wanted to kill herself before she suffered a serious illness. Apparently one of her friends had a stroke, and she was 75, and she did.
And she was healthy and active, we should say.
Yes, I did say
I'm
that.
Sorry, my apologies.
And the issue...
Not terminally ill, not any problems that I know about.
And the issue in the story was that she could not have a living will. I mean, it's made no sense to me.
Well, part of the problem was in Britain, living wills and withdrawal of treatment are harder than they are in the U.S. So I think she was nervous that she might wind up trapped on a machine or having her life prolonged. And if her boyfriend or spouse, I can't remember which it was somehow unavailable or it died, that's a tougher situation to have things stopped in Britain than it is here. All that said, boy, is this just, it's amazing to me. So this woman basically traveled and had a doctor inject her with a poison with no serious terminal illness and with no overt suffering.
And she went to Switzerland.
Except worry.
Yep.
I don't think you can do that. First of all, I think we get to a point where you have to start to say, and I don't mean to be crass about it, but if you want to end your life, you can, but I'm not sure doctors and clinics have to be set up to help people who are saying, I don't want to go through old age. That sounds to me like an encouragement rather than a necessary service like for the terminally ill. The other point I'd make is when you have people that fearful about what's going to, you know, happen to them, then you want to make sure that you are paying for the erectile dysfunction drugs and the pumps and the eyeglasses. I mean, this is the two topics are interconnected.
I couldn't agree more.
You have to cover quality of life, or you're going to have people saying, I don't want to be there. Our trigger in the U.S., just so we remember, about assisted suicide in places like Vermont, Oregon, and Washington is terminal illness.
Right.
The trigger in Belgium, Switzerland, and Holland is actually suffering. So their standard is, if you have unbearable suffering, we will help you die. But unbearable suffering covers a wide range, and it apparently includes somebody who's just fretting or worrying about what's going to happen to me as I get older. I think that's, to me, that's just too broad a runway to take euthanasia down. I think you've got a slippery slope problem. People are going to start to say, gee, you know, I had to listen to Art Kaplan on the radio. That was brutal. Kill me. There's a lot of suffering involved. So I think terminal illness is the proper bright line. I don't like where Europe is going in this case. I really don't, you know, it seems to me it's unethical to help this lady die.
Can we talk about where we're going in the United States for a second? I think Marjorie has mentioned to you, because it was an obsession of hers, the narrow failure of a ballot question. Was it 2014 or was it 2012?
Yeah, yeah.
Recent ballot campaign here in Massachusetts.
I think it was 5149.
Right, the pro death with dignity people were winning big time. Then all of a sudden, a lot of money was spent on the other side. Narrow defeat. So, what are the three states you just said now that allow it? Is that what it is? Three states?
Right, Oregon, Washington, Vermont.
So,
Vermont just beginning.
In the other 47 states, is that not the de facto situation? What's the average doctor do when he or she is confronted with someone says, I don't live in those three states, I can't take this anymore. You just told me I have a terminal illness. I really can't deal with this, and I can't afford to move to Vermont or whatever. What does the average doctor do now?
So if you're in the hospital and you're really sick and you're talking to the family, there is an odd conversation that often goes on that says, you know, we're going to control Art's pain. He's really, really sick. The cancer is spread anywhere. He's not going to die tomorrow, but he isn't going to make it past, you know, 30, 60 days, and he seems to be in a ton of pain. Do you want us to push the pain meds? When you push the pain meds, you suppress the respiration of the person. They probably cause them to die. Catholics can say it's a double effect, meaning I didn't intend to kill Art. I just wanted to get rid of his pain. If he dies as a side effect, okay, I accept it. But the honest answer is, there are conversations in the hospital that do involve what I'll call accelerating death. It does happen. We did a survey of it about 10 years ago, and I think 80% of nurses who worked in ICUs told us that they'd been involved in one such case at least within the past year.
80%, so you said?
80%.
80%.
Wow. Now, that's ICU nurses.
Understood.
But still, high number. Outside the hospital, you know what happens? Let's say you had MS or cystic fibrosis or some other ALS, some terrible debilitating disease. If you're lucky and you have a doc that you can sort of talk to and get this going, you start to hoard pills. And I won't say suicides are common, but they're out there. And so people do store medications. The doctor knows they're doing it because they write prescriptions that are bigger than the person needs. So you basically, the answer is there is an underground practice, but it's not fair because not everybody gets access to it. I'll say the better off in the middle class, you know, they usually can negotiate. I think the poor, as with many things, they just don't have that kind of trusting long-term relationship. So for them, it gets to be a lot of suffering.
But, you know, one thing I want to just interject here, I did a story several months ago at the Conversation Project. Ellen Goodman, the former Boston Globe columnist, kind of started this, talking about the scenario where you do have Art in terrible pain and he's not going to die tomorrow, but he may be gone in 30 or 60 days, where the family can't agree. So, you know, two kids say, yeah, load dad up with pain medication. Two kids say, no, let's try to do everything we can, even though they're saying he's not going to survive, which is why it's important for everybody to be on the same page, right?
Absolutely. So the most important thing you can do when you fill out your living will or advance directive, which you should, is to pick a single decision maker.
Right.
All too often, somebody writes down, my family will decide.
Yeah.
And that's disaster. I know I'm going to wind up in those cases because families often fight and they play out all their old guilt things.
Exactly.
And mom like you better. So you have to really pick one decision maker. And what's coming up now? Thanksgiving's coming up now.
Yeah.
Pretty soon. Everybody will be there. You can look around the table, and that's the selection of people that are likely to be there if you get very sick. I can't help you with that, but there they are. That's who likely present themselves, and you should have a conversation. You know, I used to joke and say, every Thanksgiving, the Detroit Lions used to play. they were the football game on Thanksgiving, sure. and they were getting killed. So they were a natural way to get into discussion of yeah. what do you want when you die? They're dying every Thanksgiving. You can talk about it.
But yeah, I can relate to what you said. I'm an only child, and my mother preferred my siblings. It was incredible. It was really painful.
There you go.
Now, you know, speaking of deaths
anything. Yeah, that is, anything. Right. Rangers, anything.
Speaking of deaths for a second, if we can, Chelsea Murs, our colleague here, told us you wanted to talk apparently about some other famous deaths from a long time ago. People, I assume, remember that the day the music died was when people like Buddy Holly, Ritchie Valens, et cetera, that plane crash. And then, 12 years, 13 years later, Don McLean wrote American Pie, 8.5 minutes of American Pie. And you apparently have your undies in a bundle, if I may use that expression, about him selling the lyrics, decades later, to American Pie and trying to explain what he meant. What's your problem?
So apparently, to sell it, he had to sort of explain finally what it meant. Now, anybody, I don't know, older than 50 probably remembers this American Pie song. This was the Bye Bye American Pie.
Absolutely.
Drove my Chevy to the levee, blah, blah, blah. So the question always was like he on drugs or did he actually have a story to tell there? So he claims now that, he was really trying to paint a picture of America going downhill. For those of you who were big on America going downhill, what was that, 30 years ago we were going downhill? So,
yeah.
And in any event, the hill is still there, and we can go down it further, but he thought we were going down one then. I'm irritated, not that he sold it, but that it took him, somebody willing to buy his lyric sheet to explain his stupid song. I've been trying to figure that song out, I don't know, all through college, let's put it that way, and beyond. I thought either this guy is some kind of raving schizophrenic, or he has an important message to tell us. I'm not sure what the song is about. Now he tells me, after all those many years, that no, it was serious, and he was trying to get a message across. That's what takes me off.
So let me be clear. You don't care about a hitchbot being assassinated, but you do care that Don McLean raised $1 million to tell people what he allegedly was saying in American Pie. Is that correct?
That's pretty much it.
Okay, fine.
And if you have your moral compass straight, you'd understand this.
Well,
again, I want to point out, you take a garbage bag and a baggie and put it over a garbage can and send it to Philadelphia, they treat it like trash.
We have to point out here that while Don McLean sold his lyrics for $1.2 million, we're happy to say that Bob Dylan beat him when he sold the manuscript from Like a Rolling Stone. Apparently, it was for $2 million, so I like that.
So what's the Everyday Ethics podcast there, Art Kaplan?
Cecil, we're going to go to the Lion and talk a little bit about should there be big game hunting at all. You know, there's some argument that you cull out the herd with the older ones, but boy, it's hard for me to defend that practice at all.
Good.
We'll add it to next week's list. Art, it's a pleasure to talk to you as always.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Thank you very much, Art Kaplan, who joins us every Wednesday. He is head of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU's Langone Medical Center. He's also the co-host of the Everyday Ethics podcast.